Good evening, my dear brothers and sisters. In the last address in this series, we concluded with Nehemiah's arrival in Jerusalem and the appeal to his fellow Jews to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. He had explained to them how the hand of God had been good upon him, and as a result of his exhortation, the Jews in Jerusalem had committed themselves to rise up and build. But their desire to restore the fortunes of Jerusalem was met with antagonism from the surrounding Samaritans. And so we read in Nehemiah chapter 4 and verse 1, "But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews." So in tonight's study we will look at the rebuilding work and how the Jews resisted the Samaritan opposition. To begin with, we need to remember the degree to which the city had fallen into disrepair. The destruction of the city caused by the original Babylonian siege had been followed by subsequent decades of neglect. These are Nehemiah's words to his fellow Jews after completing his survey of the city's defences. "You see the distress that we're in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire." Now Jerusalem had at least 10 gates in its relatively short perimeter. 10 breaches in the defences that would be impractical to defend if there was a concerted attack from a numerically superior enemy. But the missing gates were only part of the problem. The original report that Nehemiah had received from his brother Hanani described how the walls of Jerusalem were broken down, and the extent of the damage can be gauged from the fact that even after a period of sustained building, the walls were only restored to half their proper height, as we see from verse 6 of Nehemiah 4. "So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." It is also clear that the materials available for rebuilding were less than ideal, as we can see from Sanballat's scathing comments recorded in Nehemiah chapter 4 and verse 2. "Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?" It seems there was no opportunity to quarry fresh stones from the mountains, and so the wall had to be rebuilt using the rubble left from the walls destroyed by the Babylonians. Those stones had been subject to the effects of intense heat, and as a result would be soft and crumbly. Tobiah, recognising the inherent weakness of the materials that were to hand, adds his insult. "Whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." So the city had lain desolate for approximately 150 years, and the Jews of Nehemiah's day would have no personal memory of how the city used to be. Successive generations had accepted the status quo and had done nothing to restore the city. Therefore we are given, I think, an insight into the inspirational leadership of Nehemiah, for his exhortations and his example encouraged the Jews to throw off the inertia of generations. Following his appeal, the Jews committed themselves to following Nehemiah's lead. They declared, chapter 2, verse 18, "Let us rise up and build." And most importantly, their words were followed up by action, for the verse goes on to describe how they set their hands to this good work. The news that the Jews intended to start building soon reached Sanballat's ears, as we see from verse 19 of chapter 2. "But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?'" This verse implies two things. First, the news could not have come to Sanballat's attention by observing work being done on the wall, for reconstruction had not yet started. The news must therefore have come from spies and or informers in Jerusalem who relayed the news to Samaria. Internal dissent and treachery were to be a continuing problem for Nehemiah, as we shall see later. The second point from this verse is that a key Samaritan weapon was mockery and ridicule. We read, "They laughed at us and despised us." Ridicule can be a very powerful force, but on this occasion it was ineffective. Consequently, the Samaritans resorted to threats and finally attempted the force of arms. But the Jews never stepped back from their commitment to build the walls of Jerusalem, a fact that speaks volumes for the inspirational leadership of Nehemiah. Perhaps Nehemiah encouraged the Jews by reminding them of the words of the prophets, who, though foretelling the desolations of Jerusalem, also proclaimed its subsequent restoration. The returned exiles would certainly be uplifted by words such as these taken from Isaiah chapter 26. In that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. God will appoint salvation for walls and bulwarks. Open the gates that the righteous nation which keeps the truth may enter in. You will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you, because he trusts in you. More specifically, we have the words of Jeremiah, who in that great restoration chapter, chapter 31, says in verse 38, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that the city shall be built for the Lord from the tower of Hananel to the corner gate." These two features, the tower of Hananel and the corner gate, are mentioned in Nehemiah chapter 3 as being rebuilt by Nehemiah himself. Well, the map on the handout shows the probable layout of the city walls that Nehemiah rebuilt, and it indicates the approximate position of many of the features that are mentioned in chapter 3. In the verse we just quoted from Jeremiah, the prophet speaks of Jerusalem being built from the Tower of Hananel to the corner gate. Well, Nehemiah chapter 3 and verse 1 refers to the Tower of Hananel, that's shown at about 12 o'clock on the map, and verse 31 to the corner between the muster and sheep gates at the extreme northeast corner of the city. Thus Jeremiah foretells the rebuilding of the same circuit of walls as is described in Nehemiah chapter 3. And he concludes his prophecy with the assuring promise that the city shall be holy to the Lord. It shall not be plucked up or thrown down any more forever. Surely such words would encourage the Jews, even if they realized that their work was not the ultimate fulfillment of those prophetic words. But to give an idea of the size of Nehemiah's Jerusalem, the city, as shown on the map, would extend from Berwick and Dorothy's old place in the north to Don and Ruth's in the south. The widest part of the city would extend from Bramerton Street in the east to Mill Lane in the west. A city that is quite a bit smaller than we would expect of a capital, perhaps. However, we should mention, as noted on the handout, some scholars think the southern part of the city extended further to the west, such that the overall shape of the city would be approximately rectangular. But we will proceed on the basis of the map as shown. But for now, don't worry about the detail of all the place names, but we will be referring later to the five gates highlighted by the blue arrows. Well, if you go through chapter 3 of Nehemiah and count the list of teams, it indicates that the rebuilding of the wall was divided into 42 separate sections. The teams of workers are listed in sequence. As you can see, each group of builders is described as working next to the group preceding them in the list. The sequence begins with Eliashib and his fellow priests, who were responsible for the sheep gate, that's number one shown on the chart, that is located in the northeast corner of the city, and then the teams go in a counterclockwise direction around the walls until we return to the sheep gate again in verse 32. It seems that each section of the wall was repaired by the people who lived in the vicinity of that particular section. This is specifically stated in a number of places. For example, verse 10, Jediah the son of Harumaph made repairs in front of his house. And again in verse 17, Hashabiah, leader of half the district of Kelah, made repairs for his district. Such an arrangement was sensible from two points of view. First of all, it was good motivationally. The local inhabitants would have vested interest in making their part of the wall secure and robust. But it also made sense logistically. It meant that each separate workforce lived near the section for which they were responsible, therefore maximising the time and energy available for the building work. It also avoided the potential competition and argument over who had the easiest section, or the most prestigious one. In addition, it seems that Nehemiah tried to balance the workload by allocating shorter sections of the wall in those parts where the destruction was most severe. The evidence of this is one of those undesigned coincidences that is the hallmark of truth. So what is the evidence? Well, when Nehemiah did his initial survey of the walls, he left the city via the valley gate, that's number 2 on the chart, in the western wall, and he travelled round the perimeter in a counterclockwise direction. Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 14 records how he went on to the fountain gate, that's number 4, and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. Thus we see that after he passed the fountain gate, the accumulation of rubble was so severe that he had to make a detour and view the wall from a distance. Well, the teams that had the responsibility for the work beyond the fountain gate are described beginning in verse 15. After the fountain gate, the next gate in the list is the water gate, that's number 5 on the chart, and this is described in verse 26. Counting the list of teams between verses 15 and 26, we find there were 14 teams working on that section of the wall. As we mentioned earlier, there were 42 teams of workers in all. Thus, exactly one-third of the workforce was allocated to this short section. Now, if you look at the map and the scale, you can see that the length of the wall between the fountain and water gates is approximately 300 yards. That means that on average, in this section, each team had responsibility for just over 20 yards of the wall. In contrast, we see from Nehemiah 3 and verse 13 that Hanan and the inhabitants of Zanoah repaired the valley gate, that's number 2. They built it, hung its doors with its bolts and bars, and repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the refuse gate, or the dung gate, that's number 3. 1,000 cubits is 500 yards, so this one team had to rebuild nearly twice as much as the 14 teams working on the most dilapidated part of the wall. This arrangement of the workforce is a powerful illustration of Nehemiah's planning and organisational ability, and of his man management skills. As we go through the detailed list of names in Nehemiah 3, we can easily pass over another interesting detail. There was one notable exception to the practice we have just described, that of building the wall adjacent to where you lived. That exception was Eliashib the high priest. Nehemiah 3 and verse 1 tells us, "Then Eliashib the high priest rose up with his brethren the priests and built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They built as far as the Tower of the Hundred and consecrated it, then as far as the Tower of Hananel." As we've seen, the sheep gate was at the northeast corner of the city, and it was the gate through which the sacrificial animals were brought into the temple. So the priesthood were repairing adjacent to the house for which they had responsibility, namely the temple, the house of God. But although the priests worked adjacent to the house of God, they also took responsibility for the parts of the wall adjacent to their own dwellings, as verse 28 makes clear. Beyond the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. All that is, except Eliashib the high priest. For we are explicitly told in verses 20 and 21 that the part of the wall where he had his residence was repaired by others. After him, Barak the son of Zabai carefully repaired the other section, from the buttress to the door of the house of Eliashib the high priest. After him, Merimoth the son of Urijah the son of Koz repaired another section, from the door of the house of Eliashib to the end of the house of Eliashib. Maybe the high priest left the wall by his house to others, so he could concentrate on securing the wall closest to the temple area. Sadly, this explanation seems unlikely, for it seems that his heart was not in the work. We say this because Eliashib is a notable absentee in the major events recorded later in Nehemiah. Firstly, at the great reading of the law, Eliashib the high priest is not amongst those who stood on the great wooden platform with Ezra. It was not Eliashib who proclaimed the law, it was Ezra the scribe. Was the contemporary prophet Malachi alluding to this when he said, "For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts"? But the people did not receive the law from the high priest. They received it from Ezra the scribe. Then, after the great confession of the nation's sins in chapter 9, Eliashib the high priest is not listed among those who signed the covenant, when one would expect the high priest would be amongst the first to step forward. Finally, when the wall was dedicated, many priests are listed as forming part of the two choirs that marched in opposite directions around the wall. But Eliashib is not named. And the reason becomes clear in the final chapter of Nehemiah. As we mentioned last time, Nehemiah returned to Babylon for an unspecified period of time. And it was during this period that Eliashib's true colours were seen, for he is the cause of a flagrant breach of the law. In Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 4 we read that Eliashib the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah. Then after certain days I, that is Nehemiah, obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem, and discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God, and it grieved me bitterly. Not only was Tobiah an inveterate enemy of the Jewish cause, he was an Ammonite, and the law was very clear that an Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord even to the tenth generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord for ever. Not only had Eliashib allowed an Ammonite into the temple, he had allowed God's house to be treated as a hotel for foreign dignitaries. Eliashib had begun by sanctifying the gate that led into the temple courts, but he later profaned the doors of the temple itself by allowing admission to the enemy of God's people. And the downward trend continued, for we read in Nehemiah 13:28, "And one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Therefore I drove him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood, and the covenant of the priesthood, and the Levites." Tellingly, these are almost identical words to those spoken by Malachi when he condemned the priesthood. Following the words we quoted earlier, the prophet continues in verse 8 of Malachi 2, "But you have departed from the way, you have caused many to stumble at the law, you have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts." Perhaps Eliashib was worn down by the continual sniping and cajoling of Tobiah and his colleagues, but whatever the cause, his family defiled the priesthood. But now let us concentrate on the many positive examples recorded for us in chapter 3. Clearly the list is too lengthy to look at all the names given there, so we will just make a few general observations and pick on one or two particular examples. Of special note is how everyone got stuck into the task, no matter what their age or their social class. The leaders of Jerusalem's districts did their part. They were used to instructing others, but they rolled their sleeves up and got stuck in, as we see from verse 12. and the daughters of one of those leaders joined in the hard manual labour too. Similarly, we read of merchants, artisans and priests working side by side. But verse 20 has to be my personal favourite. After him, Barak the son of Zabai carefully repaired the other section, from the buttress to the door of the house of Eliashib the high priest. Based on our earlier findings, Barak was working on the most difficult and damaged part of the wall. Yet we are told he worked carefully. Other versions give the word as earnestly, zealously, valiantly. Well, careful, zealous, valiant, surely these are characteristics we should seek to emulate in our work for God. In stark contrast to Barak, there was another group that were less than enthusiastic. The Tekoites often get a bad press because their nobles were a rotten apple in the basket. Nehemiah 3 and 5 reads, "Next to them the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of their lord." But the common people among the Tekoites were not tarred with that same brush, for we find that they were willing to take responsibility for two sections of the wall, as we see from verse 5, and then again in verse 27. So why were the nobles themselves so dilatory? It seems quite possible that the Tekoite nobles didn't support the work because they were actually pledged to Tobiah. Nehemiah 6 and verse 17 tells us that also in those days the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came to them, for many in Judah were pledged to him. This third column within Jerusalem is identified as being comprised of the nobles of Judah, and Tekoa was a city of Judah. Therefore the nobles of Judah would include the Tekoite nobles, and perhaps their unwillingness to work was their way of trying to disrupt progress on the wall. But the Tekoite nobles apart, we have many encouraging examples of cooperation and commitment. As well as direct exhortation, we should perhaps also see these verses as an enacted parable. This parable becomes apparent when considered in the light of some familiar passages in the New Testament. The endeavour of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem begins with the survey by Nehemiah of the state of Jerusalem's defences. We read that Nehemiah arose in the night. "I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me, except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down, and its gates which were burned with fire." In conducting this survey, Nehemiah was assessing the practicality of realizing his ambition. It surely echoes Jesus' parable about the commitment that is required if we are to be his disciples. He said, "For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest, after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.'" And as we shall see shortly, the Samaritan opposition were quick to mock the efforts of the Jews. But Nehemiah had assessed the effort and the materials required. He knew that with the right level of cooperation and commitment, and with the blessing of God, the tower could be finished. And he was right. But Nehemiah couldn't do it alone. As we say, it required the right level of cooperation and commitment from his fellow builders. That in the main is what we have seen in Nehemiah chapter 3. And surely it is a practical illustration of Paul's exhortation in the 1 Corinthians. "For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, you are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me, as a wise master builder I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive a reward. Well, the returned exiles did indeed build, and their work was to be tested, not by literal fire, but by the heat of the Samaritan opposition. As we have seen, they had to build the wall from rubble, which would have to be packed between two stone walls. From what I have read, a rubble wall was a practical solution, particularly given the constraints of time and manpower available. If the Samaritans were to be outmanoeuvred, the wall had to go up quickly. As we've seen, in the main the workmen were goldsmiths, perfumers and merchants, hardly expert builders, but they could easily pack rubble into retaining walls under the supervision of a few stonemasons. So now we turn to the opening verses of Nehemiah 4, which describe the threats the Jews had to contend with. But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant, and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria, and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?" So the opposition begins with mockery and ridicule. But it is easy to miss the fact that this ridicule was spoken in the presence of his brethren and the army of Samaria. So Sanballat's troops were gathered outside the walls of the city, a less than veiled threat that if the Jews didn't abandon their enterprise, more direct action would commence. But the progress made by the Jews was swift, for as we see from verses 6 and 7, by the time the Samaritans were aware of what was going on, the wall was already up to half its intended height. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored, and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry. We note from this passage that a new group had joined the confederacy opposing Nehemiah. That new group is the Ashdodites. Thus there were enemies on every side, Samaritans to the north, Ammonites to the east, Arabs to the south, and now the Ashdodites from the coastal plain in the west. And not content with mockery, we see from verse 8 that all of them conspire together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Faced with such an assembly of foes, Nehemiah calls on God. His prayer is in verses 4 and 5. He says, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity. Do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." Many have criticized such so-called imprecatory prayers as not showing the spirit of Christ. But Nehemiah was not seeking personal revenge. He was asking God to act. And as Romans 12:9 states, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says the Lord. And in making his request for God to intervene, Nehemiah was calling on the promise of God, established in the Abrahamic covenant. "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you." But did God answer Nehemiah's prayer? There is no record of the intervention by angels, no hint that a plague wiped out the Samaritan forces, no news of invading armies that would draw off any attack. So did God ignore Nehemiah's appeal? Well, I think God heard, and God acted, but not in the way that Nehemiah probably anticipated, or we might have expected. I believe a miracle must have taken place, and it did indeed turn the Samaritan reproaches back on their own heads. The miracle that occurred in response to Nehemiah's prayer was surely seen in the speed and robustness with which Jerusalem's walls were rebuilt. A mere 52 days was a truly remarkable period in which to complete the wall, and it can only be understood in the context of divine help. The reproach that had been levelled against the Jews was that a fox could break down their wall. Now, seeing the quality of the wall and that it was already up to half height, the Samaritans realized that their propaganda campaign had failed. So verses 7 and 8 record that when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored, all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Knowing that such an attack was imminent, Nehemiah prays, but he also does his part by organizing watchmen and arranging his defensive forces. But at the key moment, another significant problem emerges to threaten the enterprise. This time the threat is not from the Samaritans, but from the disillusionment of some of the Jewish workers, as we see from verse 10. Then Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing. There is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall." I wonder why we're told that this note of despair is attributed to Judah. Given the rate at which progress was being made, the assertion seems to be untrue. So perhaps this was the Tekoite nobles once again trying to disrupt the work by sowing seeds of doubt amongst the builders. Further pressure was placed on the builders by reports of the threats being made by the Samaritans. It seems that some of the Jews from the surrounding countryside were coming into the city for protection and bringing with them news of the military campaign being planned by Sanballat. So we read in verse 11, "Our adversaries said, 'They will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease.' So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them, the Samaritans, came, that they told us 10 times, 'From whatever place you turn, they will be upon us.'" This implies that the threatened attack was to come from several quarters at once, in the hope of making the defenders spread their resources to breaking point, and thereby allow a breach to be made in the wall. Those words, "They told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn they will be upon us," are apparently quite difficult to translate. I wonder if they should be taken to imply that there were to be 10 separate attacks on the city walls. This may have been a deliberate exaggeration to discourage the Jews, but it might also just be true. If you go through the gates under repair, as listed in Nehemiah 3, you find that there are in fact 10. The sheep gate, the fish gate, the old gate, the valley gate, the refuse gate, the fountain gate, the water gate, the horse gate, the east gate, and the mifkad or muster gate. So perhaps the plan was to attack each gate simultaneously, as these were likely to be the weak points. Nehemiah 6 and verse 1 tells us that Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall, and that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors in the gates. Well, the leaves of the gates could not be made properly secure until the walls were at full height, so until that point was reached, the gates were particularly vulnerable to attack. As well as being a man of prayer, Nehemiah was a man of action, and now he takes on an additional role of army general, mobilizing and assigning his forces. Verse 13 reads how, "I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall, at the openings." Does the reference to the openings here reinforce the idea that the 10 gates were the primary targets for the attack? "And I set people according to their families, with their swords, their spears, and their bows." But as well as organising their military strategy, Nehemiah encourages the people. When he first arrived in the city, he had told them of the good hand of his God. So now he reassures them that that same God was still with them. Thus he exhorts in verse 14, I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders and the rest of the people, Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives and your houses. Because of the way that Nehemiah organized his defences, and because the people responded so valiantly to his exhortation, verse 15 tells us that the Samaritan threat proved to be nothing more than the blustering of a bully. And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us, and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, every one to his work. There's a nice little point that comes from this verse. Nehemiah doesn't describe their escape to his own foresight, to his defensive strategy, or even the bravery and commitment of his fellow Jews. The man of faith realized and freely acknowledged that it was God and God alone who had brought the Samaritan plot to nothing. But although the Jews returned to their building work, they remained as active soldiers, as verse 16 explains. So it was from that time on that half my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armour. Nehemiah was leading from the front. He was not sitting in comfort in the governor's residence, issuing instructions to everyone else, whilst he was waited on by a retinue of servants. All of his servants were committed to the front line, either as builders or as guards. And Nehemiah was in the very thick of things, coordinating everything with the signal trumpeter by his side. He was the governor responsible for the administration of the city. He was clerk of works supervising the construction. He was the general mobilizing and organizing his armed forces. And as we shall see in a later class, he was a benefactor and a promoter of the laws of God. He is for us a great example of a man whose faith moved him to perform mighty deeds. But the men and women of Jerusalem were equally committed, as we see from verse 17. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built. Builders and soldiers. Building the holy city and defending it against attack. Surely a perfect metaphor for the Christian, who must also be a builder and a soldier. We have already quoted Paul's words about our work as builders. According to the grace of God which was given to me, as a wise master builder I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Paul also exhorted Timothy, You must therefore endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. So I think we should look at these chapters as both instruction and encouragement. And the concluding verses of chapter 4 give us a final exhortation. Verses 21 and 22 read, So we laboured in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time I also said to the people, Let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. There we have it. Full-time commitment, working for God from daybreak until the stars appeared. Even during their necessary rest periods, the people stayed in Jerusalem, and our aspiration too must be to make the heavenly Jerusalem a permanent abode. And is it reading too much into the narrative to see significance in the fact that they washed and changed their clothes, as verse 23 explains? So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. The Christian soldier does the same thing. He washes and changes his clothes. He must wash in the waters of baptism, thereby putting off the old man and putting on the new, shedding the filthy garments of sin and clothing himself with the righteousness that is Christ's. So if we have that full-time commitment, if we aspire to be part of the heavenly Jerusalem, and if we endeavour to put off the old man and put on the new, then as Nehemiah assured the Jews in Jerusalem, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. It was certainly true for the returned exiles, and it can just as certainly be true for us.